Let's read a little. Let's turn to Ezekiel chapter 38. Brother Aaron has asked us to read a few verses here before he begins his lecture. Chapter 38, we're going to read verse beginning at 1 and read through 17. Now the word of Yahweh came to me saying, Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus says Adonai Yahweh, Behold, I am with you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. I will turn you around, put hooks into your jaws, and lead you out with all your army, horses, and horsemen, all splendidly clothed, a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya are with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer and all its troops, the house of Togarmah from the far north and all its troops, many people are with you. Prepare yourself and be ready, you and all your companies that are gathered about you, and be a guard for them. After many days, you will be visited. In the latter years, you will come into the land of those brought back from the sword and gathered from many people on the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. They were brought out of the nations, and now all of them dwell safely. You will ascend, coming like a storm, covering the land like a cloud, you and all your troops and many peoples with you. Thus says Adonai Yahweh, on that day it shall come to pass that thoughts will arise in your mind and you will make an evil plan. You will say, I will go up against the land of unwalled villages. I will go to a peaceful people who dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take plunder and to take booty and to stretch out your hand against the waste places that are again inhabited and against a people gathered from the nations who have acquired livestock and goods who dwell in the midst of the land. Sheba, Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, and all the young lions will say to you, Have you come to take plunder? Have you gathered your army to take booty, to carry away silver and gold, and take away livestock and goods, to take great plunder? Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to God, Gog, prophesy and say to Gog, Thus says Adonai Yahweh, on that day when my people dwell safely, will you not know it? Then you will come from your place out of the far north, you and many peoples with you, all of them riding on horses, a great company and a mighty army. You will come up against my people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. It will be in the latter days that I will bring you against my land, so that the nations may know me, when I am hallowed in you, O Gog, before their eyes. Thus says Adonai Yahweh, Are you he of whom I have spoken in the former days by my servants, the prophets of Israel, who prophesied for years in those days that I would bring you against them? Okay, we'll turn our attention now to Brother Aaron.
Good evening. Our subject for tonight, as well as an exhortation tomorrow morning and then tomorrow evening, is on the subject of Russia. Now tonight we're going to focus on a specific part of this issue in regarding its role in latter-day events, part one is identification. Identifying from the scriptures, not just Ezekiel 38, of the rise of this grand enemy of Christ and the saints, and the focus being the invasion of Israel. We want to clearly identify this evening who we are talking about. Tomorrow morning, we're going to talk about the invasion itself and the destruction of God. And then tomorrow evening, we want to focus on Russia today, the rise of Russia, the rise of an autocrat. Now, for those who are paying attention to and honestly assessing world developments, it will be understood that it is a world that is coming apart at the seams. Once powerful nations and alliances are crumbling, the U.S. itself, the unprecedented and undisputed economic and military champion of the 20th century, is on the verge of economic collapse and has surrendered its military dominance to Russia and Chinese ambitions. Europe is steeped in social chaos due to the invasion of Muslim refugees. Eastern Europe stands in fear of being overtaken by the might of Russian military power. It's not in the news very much, but it's very much a clear and present issue. The Middle East is now under the virtual control of Russia. China is seizing control of the South and East Pacific. The cultural collapse of the West that has championed narcissism, self-esteem, godlessness, and engrossed itself with entertainment, sport, and trivia has left generations apathetic and emotionally stunted and completely devoid of any sense of right and wrong, self-reliance, or common sense. Men's hearts are failing them for fear, as it seems that the way forward can only spell disaster. The almost incomprehensible problems man has created for himself have, by all logical appearances, reached a breaking point. The pursuit of the utopian dream of world peace and human rights, so-called, to the rejection of God that arose out of the ashes of World War II, has only proven to create even greater difficulties, greater corruption, greater debt, greater inequalities and injustices, greater brutalities and barbarism, and even greater ambitions for world dominance by certain nations. With this backdrop, even those of the world who have some religious conviction, although false in nature, have a vague sense that the time has come for God to intervene directly in the affairs of men, and as they put it, that the end of the world has come. Social and political upheavals, wars and rumors of wars have been a constant reality of the history of mankind. Therefore, throughout history, men have come to think that the end of all things, or the end of the world, was coming in their time. Though we know that there is no end of the world, or an end to man's existence on earth, as promoted by evangelical Christianity, we do believe, to the point of great certainty, that the end of the Gentile order, or cosmos, is at hand. Now, how can we be sure? Because we believe in the Word of God. We have a grasp of its prophetic message. Prophetic time periods are almost exhausted. We see the prophetic signs coming together exactly as was foretold. And we have witnessed the revival, as was spoken of this morning, of the modern Jewish state, which is a precursor to great and terrible events leading to the return of Christ. On top of these things, mankind has corrupted himself in this earth to a point that really can go no further, except for a collapse of the human race itself. We also see the latter-day revival of the apostolic faith all but evaporated. Some may think we exaggerate, that we are being too dramatic or too negative, but an honest and hopefully objective view of facts, should indicate to us that man can go no further without something quite extraordinary interjecting itself into the world affairs to change the course of human history. Now this leads us to our opening reading in Ezekiel 38. This prophecy and all other supporting prophecies, found throughout the scriptures marks a watershed moment in God's plan for this earth. Before this grand invasion is completed upon the land of Israel, Nebuchadnezzar's image will begin to stand to be manifested in full manifestation as this process of invasion carries through, and will be an amalgamation of a great confederacy of Eastern and Western Europe, much of Asia into the Middle East, and parts of Northern Africa. A combination of the territories once held by Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, the likes of which, when it stands in full completion, victorious over the Israeli or former Israeli nation, the likes of which the world has never seen before in magnitude. When the invasion commences, the confederacy needed has been compared by other expositors as being similar to the Roman Empire during the time of Justinian in the 6th century, with civil and military authority established and associated with the East in Constantinople in cooperation with a religious head centered in Rome. Now, there are three primary political and religious enemies of Yahweh. There are three that are prophetically focused upon in regard to the last days. Revelation 16 and 13 refers to them as the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. Now, we're not going to get into detail regarding the identification and what leads up to the identification of these three, but we're going to simply state the dragon is apocalyptically in reference to Russia, as we will soon see, the beast to Western Europe, and the false prophet to the papacy or Catholic system. Though all will be in cooperation for the invasion of the land of Israel, it is the dragon, or Russia, and her military allies that are to be the first to face the fiery wrath of the Yahweh of armies and be destroyed by the open manifestation of God's power in front of a shocked and terrified world. They will be the first to fall. As we read in Ezekiel 38, 21, and 22, 23, and hopefully you'll keep your fingers there in that chapter. We'll kind of be back and forth. Verse 21, "And I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith Adonai Yahweh. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. And I will plead against him with pestilence and with blood, and I will rain upon him and upon his bands and upon the many people that are with him an overflowing rain and great hailstones, fire, and brimstone. Thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am Yahweh." Now, for the sake of perspective, it is to be understood that Christ will have already returned to the earth, unseen by the world, to raise those who have died under the terms of the everlasting covenant, and to gather both dead and living of his saints to judgment at Sinai. During this time of judgment and union between Christ and his immortalized saints, hidden from the world's view, Israel will be dwelling securely or confidently, while the autocrat of Russia, and we'll explain that term autocrat more in just a moment, the autocrat of Russia will have fully secured a confederacy in which to make his final move against the Holy Land. Christ has not yet returned, but we are currently seeing remarkable movements by Russia to build this latter-day empire that by its invasion and destruction of Israel will instigate the overthrow of all that the Nebuchadnezzar dream image represents, as well as all Gentile power throughout the earth, and replace it with God's kingdom. As we read in Daniel chapter 2, verse 44. Daniel 2, 44. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. But how do we know that the role of instigator is to be played by Russia? Brethren, since the days of Brother Thomas's exposition on the matter, have understood Russia and her allies to be a key component of Nebuchadnezzar's image. The gold of Ezekiel 38 and 39, the latter-day king of the north of Daniel 11, as well as the latter-day Assyrian. But how did they know, and how do we know? What identifiers do we have in the scriptures that help us to understand that Russia is to be watched closely, and that her present activities warn us to the fact that we are in truth living in the time of the end? What exactly will Russia do to Israel? Who will be confederate with Israel? Those are the questions that we wish to address tonight and tomorrow. Part 1, identification. We first wish to establish the fact that the detailed prophecy of the invasion of Israel by the Gogian host as found in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is not an isolated prophecy. We cannot stress that point enough. The prophecy of the Gogian host, as found in Ezekiel 38 and 39, is not an isolated prophecy, as some Christadelphian expositors have contended. Some brethren in recent years have tried to claim that what is described here stands alone and is not found in any other parts of Scriptures where further details and complementary bits of information may be found. Therefore, it is concluded that this prophecy has no major significance on latter-day events, no major significance in regard to Israel itself, and that the Gogian host, as we just mentioned, will pose no threat to Israel in the last days. But verse 17 of the 38th chapter makes it perfectly clear to us that the great battle described in these two chapters is in fact a most profound event. One in which is a theme that can be found throughout the prophetic record, both in plain language as well as indicated in allegory by other historical events in Israel's past. It reads, "Thus saith the Lord God, Art thou he of whom I have spoken in old time by my servants the prophets of Israel, which prophesied in those days many years that I would bring thee against them?" It is spoken throughout the prophets. Also, chapter 39 and 8. "Behold, it is come, and it is done, saith the Lord God. This is the day whereof I have spoken." Now, in a similar passage to prove the point, it's not directly related to what we're talking about here, somewhat, but to prove the point, we look at Acts chapter 3 and 21, where we read of Christ. Acts chapter 3 and 21. "Whom the heaven must receive until the times of restitution of all things, which God hath spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began," or cosmos began. Now, just as the theme of the kingdom is found throughout the scriptures, especially since the foundation of the Mosaic cosmos, so too is the great battle over Zion that ushers in the times of restitution, the apokatastasis, I think I got that right, or reestablishment from a state of ruin. The reestablishment of Israel from a state of ruin. These play a prominent role in the message of the prophetic record. An isolated prophecy, we think not. It is by far the most detailed prophecy regarding the latter-day invasion and destruction of Israel, but it is supported and complemented by many other prophetic passages. We will connect to some, not all. It's too expansive. The subject is really too big. But we will connect to some of the main associated prophecies later on in our consideration, such as Daniel 11 and Joel 3. Now, how do we know that the prophecy of Ezekiel 38 and 39 is still future? If you look at some of the commentary that you may find in some Bibles, is they make it seem like it is something that was fulfilled at one time in history. Verses 8 and 16 refer to the prophecy belonging to the latter years, or the last or end years, according to your concordance. This will be as is indicated in the prophecy after there has been a gathering of the people of Israel. Not yet a full restoration, as verse 12 indicates to us that it is a people that are gathered out of the nations, but they are not mentioned as the whole house of Israel. A very important distinction. The full restoration is not until after Gog is destroyed, as is mentioned in the latter portion of the 39th chapter. As 38 and 8, verse 11 and 12 indicate, it is a people that is living in a relative sense of confidence and security and economic prosperity, but it is not the whole house of Israel. As a result of this dramatic invasion of the land of Israel and the cataclysmic destruction of this invading force at the hands of Yahweh, we are told in verse 16 and later in verse 23 that the heathen or non-Hebrew nations, the Gentiles, will be made fully aware of the power of Yahweh in open manifestation. Verse 23, thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. Therefore, the events described here in such exquisite and terrible detail have never happened. But the events leading up to this are most certainly unfolding before our very eyes. Now, Russia is the leader of this invasion. Again, how do we know that Russia will be the leader? There is no mention of the name Russia in the Scriptures. So why have Christadelphians, as well as academics and historians, been able to identify Russia in regard to this prophecy? First, we look at the name Gog, or Gog, to who this prophecy is directed. Son of man, set thy face against Gog. Back to Ezekiel 38. As a side note, son of man is initially in reference to Ezekiel, who is the mouthpiece of the prophecy. But we also understand that the title Son of Man is also a title of Christ. Therefore, the prophecy is for Christ, who will lead the military campaign to destroy this invader. The name Gog itself means to be elevated or to rise up. This Gog will certainly be elevated as a great power in the last days, one who will stand in all the pride and arrogance of the kingdom of men, as seen in the terrible image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. According to ancient Assyrian cylinders, Gog, or Gogi, or Gagi, was a chief of the Scythian peoples in the early 7th century B.C. The Scythians were a fierce, nomadic people who stretched from parts of modern-day Germany through Eastern Europe and into what we now know as Russia and into the region of Siberia. The name was given and used by the ancient Greeks to describe this far-reaching territory and its peoples. Their king was this Gag, or Gagi, or Gagai. Gog, or Gog, is the prince or leader of the following territories, which gives us more conclusive evidence. Rosh, or Rosh. In the authorized version, we read in the second verse the phrase, the chief prince. This actually is to be translated, as was read in the opening reading, is to be translated from the Hebrew as the proper name of Rosh. The word chief was understood by the Hebrew translators of the Septuagint to actually represent a proper noun. Many translations, including the Revised Version, and what was just read, I think it was the New King James Version, translate it as the proper name of Rosh. Connected to this, it should be interesting to note that of similar pronunciation is Ross, or Rus. This was the name of the ancient people who gave their name to the lands of Russia and Belarus, according to Encyclopedia Britannica. Wikipedia also provides similar information. Now, the geographer Bocart in 1640 stated that from Ross or Mesek, that is the Rossi and Moski of whom Ezekiel speaks, descended the Russians and Muscovites, nations of the greatest celebrity in European Scythia. The Byzantines and Greeks used the name of Ross or Rosh as an early name for the Russian territory. Paul Billington, in his pamphlet, The Battle for the Middle East, states, "Now is it not remarkable that the Septuagint translators, 280 years before Christ, should choose the very word that the Byzantines and Greeks used as the early name of Russia?" Next, Meshech. The word Meshech, and I think this is interesting when you look these up, Meshech means a drawing out. Keep that in mind, a drawing out. Brown's Drivers and Briggs states that the descendants of Meshech are often mentioned in connection with Tubal, Magog, and other northern nations, including the Moski. Both Meshech and Tubal are mentioned in the genealogy of Genesis chapter 10, verses 2, 3, and 6, as sons, and please note this, as sons of Japheth, which settled to the north in relation to the land of Israel. Meshech connects with the area of Muscovy and the Muscovite people, which gave rise to the city name of Moscow. Tubal means thou shalt be brought. This has been connected with the river Tobol in Siberia, which gives rise to the town of Tobolsk on the other side of the Ural Mountains. Tobolsk is the old capital of the Siberian region. This happens to be the city of Tobolsk. They call that the little Kremlin that's situated there in that high place on the River Tobol. Now, both names are quite significant. A drawing out and thou shalt be brought. As we read in verse 4 of the 38th chapter, that Yahweh will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thine army. They shall be brought, they will be drawn out for this great and grand invasion. Now Magog is a geographic location, as Magog simply means the land of God. It must be kept in connection with the fact that Gog's place is out of the north parts. The Hebrew texts speak of his location as out of the uttermost parts of the north. Again, Magog is the son of Japheth. So as we consider the fact that these names appear in Genesis chapter 10, we are being taken back to the very roots of these people. To apply this to the prophetic record, later migration patterns of these peoples must be taken into consideration from historical records. It should be noted that no descendants of Shem, Semitic people, Jews, and otherwise, it should be noted that no descendants of Shem are allied with Russia. Only descendants of Japheth and Ham are to be found. No descendants of Shem. That would be the Arab people. Are not allied in this cause. Josephus identified biblical Magog with the Scythians of Greek literature. The Greek historian Herodotus, 450 BC, placed the Scythians north of the Black Sea in a region between the River Don in Russia and the Danube River in Europe. The ancient writer Diodorus Siculus, I think I got that right, 100 BC, mapped the Scythians as far as the Baltic Sea. So we gather from the historical record that Magog includes an area that includes Russia, Ukraine, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Hungary, and into Western Germany itself. No wonder Russians' Western neighbors are extremely nervous and frightened by Russia's push westward. The Baltic states and Poland are scared to death right now. You will not read that in the American news sources. So Gog's privately controlled territory at the time of this latter-day crisis is quite massive and scripturally quite clear. We are not there yet. We are seeing dramatic moves to secure this entire territory by Putin as we speak. The leader or head of Rosh or Russia will be an autocrat, a term used by Brother Thomas in Elpis Israel to describe the Russian leader at the time of the invasion, and a very term that has been used to describe the governing style of Putin by modern-day observers and papers of the world. An autocrat is a ruler who has absolute power. And we'll talk more of this issue of an autocrat in probably tomorrow evening. Now, the territory described in Ezekiel 38 and 3 is not a complete picture in and of itself of this latter-day empire. Verse 5 goes on to identify its allies in the invasion force. First of all, Persia. Now, this is an easy one to identify, as this is modern-day Iran, including parts of Iraq. The Medes, who inhabited this territory, were descendants of Medai, another son of Japheth. The Persians are descended from Japheth. Ethiopia. Now, there is some debate about this. This is from the Hebrew Cush. Are we talking about the nation we now know as Ethiopia, or as Cush can be found in the scriptures representing the area around the Mesopotamia, are we talking about modern-day Iraq? Now, if somebody has some strong opinions on this, I am open to get hammered on this. I do not have a definitive opinion on this, and again, I'm open to input. Libya. Still the same name today. Libya. Gomer. This is a bit more challenging to trace, but according to Josephus, Gomer's descendants, the oldest son of Japheth, migrated from an initial settlement in Galatia to the area of ancient Gaul. Gaul is now known as France. Young's Concordance states that Gomer was a progenitor of the Cimmerians, the Cimbri, and other branches of the Celtic family, as well as the modern Gaul and Cimmeri. The descendants of Gomer settled on the north of the Black Sea and then spread themselves southward and westward to the extremities of Europe. You can see that right there towards your left-hand side. It needs to be noted that Ezekiel 38 and 6 states Gomer and all her bands. So his contribution to this confederacy will include all main branches of the Celtic race. This leads us to understand, along with many other prophetic indicators, that all of Western Europe will be allied with Russia. Togarma. Historians identify this area as Turkey, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. Now, before we move on, we must say that the extent of the Russian sphere of influence will be larger than what is described in Ezekiel 38, not only in regard to territory, but the very character of what this latter-day invasion of Israel will represent. As we have mentioned, what we will see at this grand time of trouble will be a virtual empire that involves both Eastern and Western Europe, large sections of the Middle East, as well as Northern Africa. Again, the totality of what is represented by Nebuchadnezzar's image, and more on that in our next class, an amalgamation of the Babylonian, Persian, Grecian, and Roman territories, the iron and clay mixture of the feet and toes, and the European political situation of Western Europe as the ten toes. and not to forget the revival of the Holy Roman Empire with a renewed influence of the papal system out of Rome. The totality of this must be constantly stressed and remembered. But really, and we want to stress this point, the full manifestation, when we refer to what we see in Nebuchadnezzar's image, is not until Russia has defeated Israel and has planted its tabernacles firmly and squarely in Jerusalem. Now, the third Rome. Other significant identifiers. Now, something that we have always found to be very fascinating in regard to Russia's role in these latter-day events. Moscow, and actually Russia, as we will see, is considered and considers itself as the third Rome, preceded by Rome, then Constantinople. Now, this is from Wikipedia. And you can say what you want to about Wikipedia, but it does have some good information. It says, the third Rome was the idea that some city-state or country is the successor to the legacy of ancient Rome, or the first Rome. After the fall of Tarnova to the Ottoman Turks in 1393, a number of Bulgarian clergymen sought shelter in the Russian lands and transferred the idea of the third Rome there, which eventually resurfaced in Tver during the reign of Boris of Tver. Within decades after the capture of Constantinople by Muhammad II of the Ottoman Empire on the 29th of May, 1453, some Eastern Orthodox people were nominating Moscow as the Third Rome, or the New Rome. Stirrings of this sentiment began during the reign of Ivan III of Russia, who had married Sophia Palilo. Sophia was a niece of Constantine XI, the last Byzantine emperor. By the rules and laws of inheritance followed by most European monarchies of the time, Ivan could claim that he and his offspring were heirs of the fallen empire. But the Roman traditions of the empire had never recognized automatic inheritance of the imperial office. A stronger claim was based on religion. The Orthodox faith was central to Byzantine notions of their identity and what distinguished them from barbarians. Vladimir the Great had converted Kievan Rus to Orthodoxy in 988, in return for which he became the first barbarian to ever get an imperial princess as a wife. So Russia has married into this position of connection to the Roman Empire. Now here is why this is scripturally significant. The understanding that the two legs of Nebuchadnezzar's image correspond with the two divisions of the Roman Empire, Rome in the west as the religious center and Constantinople in the east as the civil and military capital as established by Constantine and upheld by succeeding emperors. Constantinople was considered the second Rome and a continuation of the Roman Empire long after the Roman Empire in the west came to an end. Catholicism would eventually split itself, with Rome as the religious head of Catholicism and Constantinople as the head of Eastern Orthodoxy. Constantinople would become a stronghold of Greek culture and the Roman style of government. This Greek connection is extremely important in its association to the prophecies found in Daniel. When Constantinople fell, then referred to as Byzantium and the Byzantine Empire, still Roman, in 1453 to the Ottoman Turks, the religious authority of the Eastern Orthodoxy transferred to Russia, more specifically Moscow, where national devotion was firmly behind Eastern Orthodoxy. So the two legs, as we consider them, of Nebuchadnezzar's image, east and west. This connection is seen clearly in Russia's political and religious symbols. I'm sorry, I didn't read the rest of this. Let me back up for a second, because I think what this is really good too. The idea of Muscovy as heir to Rome crystallized with a panegyric letter composed by the Russian monk Philotheus of Pskov in 1510 to their son Grand Duke the silly, the third, which proclaimed, two Romes have fallen, the third stands, and there will be no fourth. And he's right about that. There will be no fourth. No one shall replace your Christian czardom. Contrary to the common misconception, Philate explicitly identifies third Rome with Muscovy, the country, rather than with Moscow, the city, although the term Muscovy was considered synonymous with the Russian lands at the time. Somewhat notably, Moscow is placed on seven hills, as were Rome and Constantinople. Panegyric is a public statement of high praise to a person or thing, essentially a eulogy. Now, again, this connection is clearly seen in Russia's political and religious symbols. The National Coat of Arms, and that was on our first slide that we had up there, the National Coat of Arms of Russia is the double-headed eagle, which was formerly associated with the Byzantine Empire. This symbol was also adopted by the Holy Roman Empire. The two heads have multiple meanings. The heads represent the emperor having authority over both secular and religious matters. It also signifies the dominance of the Byzantine emperors over both East and West. And the Holy Roman Empire saw it as representing church and state. We see this identification also portrayed in Russian architecture, which is Byzantine in its roots. And the Orthodox cross is placed over the Muslim crescent. You can see that, the cross over the crescent moon, to indicate the subjection of their religion over the religion of the Ottomans who took Constantinople away from them. Russia historically and continues to desire control once again of the seat of its cultural and religious roots, Constantinople. And we'll see as we go through why that's so important. The Russian emperors came to be known as czars. The first was Ivan the Great in 1462. This is a form of the ancient title of Caesar. Czar is Caesar. The title of Tsar was previously the title of the emperors of Byzantium. He was viewed as God's vice-regent on earth. Interestingly enough, the Tsar considered himself as the protector of the holy places of Palestine. Please remember that. The Tsar considered himself as the protector of the holy places of Palestine. So not only does Constantinople mean something to them, Palestine or Israel means something to them as well. And make no mistake about it, unlike Americans, these people know their history. They know their history. They know what these symbols stand for. Putin knows his history. Now, the little horn of Daniel chapter 8. Let's go quickly to Daniel chapter 8. Verses 23 through 25. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper, and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. Now the initial application and descriptors of this prophecy is that of the pagan Roman military power that arose out of the divided Grecian Empire, and eventually besieged and destroyed Jerusalem. But the eventual and full application will fall upon its political and military successor, who will arise in its place once Constantinople has been subdued and Europe submits to the will of the autocrat of Russia. A nation, like the Romans, who is highly skilled at the art of deception, and can hide its true intentions in a cloak of darkness. Even without military action, through peace, he is able to accomplish his military and political goals. And we'll talk more about this tomorrow night, but look what Russia has been able to do through peace, or peace so-called. His heart is lifted up in pride until he stands up against the prince of princes. But he shall be broken without hand. This similar statement is made regarding the stone cut that strikes the feet of Nebuchadnezzar's image, and also of the destruction of the king of the north of Daniel 11. Now, just flipping over to Daniel chapter 11, and we're not going to read these verses, but just take a look at it. Starting in the 40th verse, where it talks about at the time of the end, Daniel 11 further chronicles the development and actions of this little horn of Daniel 8, or the king of the north. First in its Greek or Seleucid stage, then when it is later manifested as the eastern military portion of the Roman Empire after Constantine had transferred all military and civil authority of the Roman Empire to Constantinople. Remembering from history where this power was transferred after the fall of Constantinople to Russia, to Moscow, we see a snapshot forward in verses 40 through 45 at the time of the end, when the king of the north in latter-day manifestation invades Egypt and the land of Israel. More on that tomorrow. Also, Agag and the Amalekites. The proper name Agag was the title for the Amalekite king. The Amalekites were the first Gentile nation to attack Israel after they crossed the Red Sea. And for this, Yahweh has declared a perpetual enmity. Agar was an Amalekite king who Samuel himself killed in the days of Saul. And Haman, who tried to destroy the Jews during the time of Esther, was also an Amalekite, or Agagite. So what does this have to do with Russia? The original Hebrew word for Agag is Gog. The words Agag and Gog are very closely related in regard to word etymology. So much so that the Septuagint renders Agag as Gog in Numbers 24 and 7, in Balaam's prophecy of the end times, and Esther 3:1 in regard to Haman as an Agagite, or Gog. Balaam, in Numbers 24, prophesying of the latter days, foretold of the destruction of Amalek at the hands of Christ. Numbers 24 and 20. And when he looked on Amalek, he took up his parable and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, or the first that warred against Israel. But his latter end shall be that he perish forever. Since the Amalekites are long finished as a people, we look to a future Gentile power to fulfill the type of an aggressor against Israel, who will be destroyed by Christ and the saints. Who other than the latter day Agag, or Gog? Christ destroyed the sin power manifested in the flesh, in his flesh, in the overcoming and destruction of his own flesh. And he is the one appointed to overcome and destroy it in its political manifestation as well. Now, other related prophecies that we are not going to consider at this time that provide overlapping as well as unique information regarding this latter-day invasion, the identity and characteristics of this latter-day confederacy, and this is not complete, Joel chapter 2 and 3, Zechariah chapters 12 through 14, Isaiah chapter 30, Isaiah chapter 34. So to summarize very quickly, again, this identification is most certain. And it is found not just in Ezekiel 38. It is found throughout the scriptures. It is found throughout history. Gog is Russia with all its allies. As we saw earlier on the map, it goes all the way to through Western Europe. It includes countries such as France, Germany. It will include Persia. It will include Libya and other countries as well. And that's where we'll close, and we'll pick up tomorrow with during the exhortation period of Russia's invasion of the land itself. Thank you.